Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
The weeds are here.
The weeds are coming from inside the house.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Dara Lind, and we also have joining us today Andrew Prokop, who is the keeper of all things Russia and Mueller and sometimes related things having to do with Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, every so often we drag Andrew into the podcast studio and go, Andrew, we've officially lost track of everything that is happening with Trump and Russia and various criminal and, you know, non-criminal investigations. Help. And so this is another round of that. Andrew,
there's
help.
A lot happening.
Yeah, now, quite a few things have happened recently. But one thing that I think just helps sort of structure this is there was a kind of flurry of reports recently that the Senate Intelligence Committee had wrapped up its investigation. And there was no collusion, or at least no proof of collusion. And, you know, I guess a good place to start is like, is that right? Like what do we know about colluding from all these sentences that have been handed out?
So I think first off, we have to separate the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation from the Mueller investigation.
Right.
They've proceeded completely separately. And these were comments by Richard Burr, the chairman of Senate Intel, a Republican from North Carolina. And he said something like they found no, in their own investigation, no direct evidence of collusion. Then the Democrats started pushing back a little bit, saying, oh, well, we found some sort of, you know, there's maybe circumstantial stuff, like questions arose from stuff we found. But, you know, they haven't released their findings, so we don't really know what it is exactly they found or didn't find. And in any case, the main event is not this committee's investigation. The main event is the Mueller investigation. And I think that when you look back at the past couple months, going back to maybe November, right after the elections, we have learned a significant amount in the new sentencing memos and new charges brought by Mueller. And what we have learned, you know, a lot of people say that, oh, all the Mueller investigation finds is process crimes, like lying to Congress, or which Roger Stone was just charged with, and obstruction, or Michael Cohen was also charged with lying to Congress, or Manafort has been charged with a bunch of kind of unrelated stuff. And, you know, it is true that still no one has yet been charged by Mueller with a criminal conspiracy to interfere with the election. However, in these filings, we seem to be getting closer to something like that. I don't know if we'll end up there, but what we've learned in the past few months involving Cohen, Manafort, and Stone have all been in the territory of sort of collusion adjacent stuff that happened during the campaign.
I also think it's worth, before we delve into the details, right? I feel like there's a constant game of sort of goalposts moving around some of this, right? Collusion is not something that you can scroll through the U.S. code and say, aha, like here is the crime of collusion. Here are the elements of collusion. If you want to prosecute someone for collusion, you need the following things, right? So if the standard is for this to be a big deal, you have to both prove a crime and you have to prove collusion, but also collusion has to be the crime that you prove. That's a really, really hard one, right? Like a possible thing in the realm of process crimes is that a person has done something. The thing that they have done is embarrassing because it would be, for example, politically devastating to be openly colluding with the Russian government during an election campaign, but perhaps not illegal. But then to cover up the embarrassing thing you did, you committed crimes. And like in a normal common sense, like that's being a criminal. You know what I mean? Having a television set is not a crime, but stealing a television set is a crime, right? And so a range of sort of realms in which something can be just process crimes, right? Like you can have legitimately done nothing wrong, but been like tripped up by clever FBI agents into contradicting your story, and now they have a crime against you. You can have a situation where you come under investigative scrutiny. It turns out they can't prove you did the thing that they thought you did, but by rummaging through your life, they find other crimes that you committed. And then there's a realm of like, you did something that you wanted to keep secret and you broke the law to cover it up, right? And that, I think when we talk about collusion adjacent, like that's what it seems like we're talking about, right? Like you have in the sentencing memos, there's a lot of like, he did this, he did that. They're trying to explain what happened, and like some of the stuff that happened seems like it involved working with the Russians on the campaign.
And I think the other thing to point out here, and it's, I'm in the bizarre position of like pointing a finger more directly at Republicans in the Trump administration than Matt is, which I'm not sure if it's ever happened on the podcast before, but like it's not just that the idea of collusion kind of emerged from the discourse as the gold standard here, right? The Trump administration worked very actively to associate the Mueller investigation with a collusion investigation. They refused to answer questions about the other element of the investigation, which is the firing of James Comey. That, you know, Donald Trump was on Twitter all the time saying that the Mueller investigation was fake because there wasn't collusion. So they're simultaneously trying to funnel it into this, the only legitimate thing they could be investigating is collusion, but, you know, bearing in mind that, yes, okay, the Comey side of this investigation is an obstruction of justice, but when you're at the point where the obstruction of justice in question would be literally firing your director of the FBI, like, how processy that process crime is versus it would be a significant problem even if there were no underlying illegal behavior starts to get a little fuzzy. But now having funneled it so narrowly into collusion, they're now saying it has to be both collusion and, because collusion, an existing federal crime.
But even leaving the question of obstruction aside, I think that we have learned several things from Mueller's charges and sentencing memos in the past few months that deserve to be treated as massive scandals, things that happened during the 2016 campaign that were not about the cover-up, but things that are, I mean, maybe not the basis of criminal charges, or maybe charges were not brought for whatever reason, but the fact that these things happen are legitimately scandalous. And there is, you're absolutely right, there's this bizarre kind of expectation setting, partly from Trump, I think also partly from the Steele dossier, which alleged such a kind of sinister conspiracy that anything that comes short of that now is treated by some as somewhat disappointing. But I don't think we've learned the full story yet either of what Mueller's found. But we have learned about, and we can go through them now, but I would characterize it as, first, there's Roger Stone and WikiLeaks, which, you know, everybody's been following the charges against him lately. We know that at the very least, he made some effort to get in touch with WikiLeaks to time WikiLeaks' release of the hacked emails that had been stolen by Russia from Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. And this is also something we don't entirely know the full story about yet. There are some indications that Stone may have known that that WikiLeaks had Podesta's emails in advance, but that has not been sort of directly alleged yet. That's kind of to be continued.
But just to reiterate that, right? Like, I mean, again, collusion is a difficult claim. But like one read of what happened in 2016 is that Donald Trump got lucky because with him and his team having nothing to do with it, thanks to poor information security processes on the part of John Podesta, the Russian government was able to access his inbox, and then the Russian government on their own, for their own unknown reasons, released these emails in a way that happened to be very fortuitous for Trump.
And on the day of the Access Hollywood tape,
and also just late in the campaign, right? Like, they didn't release it the day after they got it.
But then no one in Trump's camp was involved in any way. This just happened separately from
because, like, stuff happens in campaigns, right? So maybe Trump got lucky.
And if everybody, you know, it's not like a reasonably well-informed intelligence operative in Russia couldn't look at the calendar of a U.S. presidential campaign and go, it's generally better to release things late in the campaign. And, like, you can theoretically come up with a world where that happens.
Right.
It's just not the world we live in.
Right, or Julian Assange. But what we now seem to know from Roger Stone is that he what?
Okay, so at the very least, in July, Roger Stone was trying to get in touch with Julian Assange. And then the charges get a little complicated. And so they talk about two people, person one and person two. Person one is Jerome Corsi. He is the conspiracy theorist, former InfoWars correspondent who has, you know, stoked Obama was not born in America stuff. So Mueller has in the indictment that Stone, in July, told Corsi to get to Assange and get a hold of the pending emails he has coming. And Stone writes that he thinks these relate to the Clinton Foundation. So then, about a week later, in early August, Corsi writes back Stone this email that, for some reason, it talks about Assange's plans, and then it mentions Podesta. And that has apparently really raised investigators' eyebrows because they're like, how would he possibly know? Nobody knew at the time that Podesta had been hacked, or this was not public at least. And then a couple weeks after this, Roger Stone himself tweeted his infamous tweet of, soon it will the Podesta's time in the barrel. There are some typos in there. It doesn't entirely make grammatic sense. But Stone has been saying, you know, this was a coincidence. This was entirely unrelated. And he said that actually, you know, once this became controversial, once the WikiLeaks info started coming out, Stone said, actually, this tweet was about research that Jerome Corsi was doing for me at the time. And now Corsi is saying, in fact, Stone knew about the Podesta emails and asked me to concoct a memo as a cover story. So we're getting into pretty complex territory here. But what seems to be going on is that there was some kind of shady efforts to contact WikiLeaks, learn what WikiLeaks had, and then also perhaps later to influence the timing of WikiLeaks' release. We don't know how successful they were, but they're at the very least, Stone was trying, and he may have learned some information about what they had. And then he apparently told at least something to the Trump campaign. And there are Steve Bannon is said to have been in contact with Stone about what he knew the week of the Podesta dumps. So, you know, and again, like, Stone was charged not with any crimes related to this, but with lying to Congress about this in 2017, the next year, withholding documents and trying to intimidate a witness into giving a false story about this. And, you know, let's not get into the other witness because that just makes it more complicated. But basically, there's another guy who was talking to Assange, who Stone was kind of in touch with and getting info from.
So, you know, you mentioned at one point we don't know how successful they, you know, Stone and Corsi were in getting information. That kind of gets into one of the many defenses that have been used, which is that the Trump administration was essentially too incompetent to successfully collude with anybody, which, like, tracks with a certain understanding of, you know, it's not exactly as if anyone's assessment of how well coordinated the Donald Trump 2016 campaign was has been raised substantially by any of these revelations. But it doesn't necessarily appear to be true, given what we've seen in, you know, the documents that have been released. And it also doesn't appear to necessarily be exculpatory, right? Like, can you talk through, does the putative success or not of these attempts to find out information actually matter in a criminal sense or in a should we think of this as collusion sense?
Well, what everyone is kind of wondering is whether there are more charges coming regarding Roger Stone and WikiLeaks in some fashion, because this indictment of Stone clearly does not attempt to tell the full story or to be the last word on what he knew and exactly what happened between him and WikiLeaks in 2016. And there's an interesting tidbit recently that Mueller designated Stone's case as related to his indictment of the Russian hackers for hacking the Podesta emails in the first place. He did this because there is a common warrant used to get evidence that he said would be relevant in Stone's case. And, you know, we already know that Stone had engaged some DMs with WikiLeaks and with Guccifer II, the Russian hacker persona. What we know of these DMs so far makes them look very limited and rather innocuous. It's not entirely like they're not smoking gun DMs. It shows they were talking, but it doesn't show really that Stone knew anything or was involved in any way. But that's what people are wondering, whether there is a fuller story, a new indictment coming on this, or maybe it's also possible that we know that Mueller dug into this very deeply. He hauled basically everyone connected to Roger Stone in any way before his grand jury last year. Corsi himself has written a whole book about his experience before the grand jury. He's a very unreliable character, but you can read my explainer on things in his book that I found interesting in his account of what happened. So it seemed that at the very least they wanted to charge this larger crime. And, you know, whether they perhaps couldn't make their case or whether they still intend to do so, we don't yet know.
So what would why would you bring some indictments against Roger Stone if you're not done? Like, what would the logic of that be? Because, I mean, I think I can see that there was a sort of from Byron York and some others, like when the Stone indictments came out, it was like, okay, they like went really thoroughly at this guy. They like squeezed him really hard and like this is what they came up with. And it's not that stellar. But a lot of that hinges on the question of like, is what's known, is the fact that this is what's in the indictment reason to believe that that's all that there is, or can the investigation keep snowballing?
Yeah, I think there would be a few reasons. First of all, we should note that when Mueller first indicted Manafort, it was for a more limited set of charges, and it took a few months for I believe Justice Department bureaucratic reasons to get the tax charges and bank fraud charges added to Manafort. So, you know, there could be stuff going on behind the scenes. There could also be the question of co-conspirators and charges against other people that perhaps are not yet ready. Like if there is another go-between between Stone and WikiLeaks who we don't yet know about, or even there are said to be charges against Assange himself that are under seal right now that have already been filed. The Washington Post has reported that. So I don't know exactly what the rationale could be, or maybe it just wasn't ready. Maybe they're still working on this. There is there's one person who's very who's worked for Stone for a long time who refused to testify to the grand jury and has been held in contempt and is fighting a court battle to try to avoid testifying. So, you know, maybe they need this guy's testimony. That could be another reason to hold off.
All right, let's take a break and then let's talk about Paul Manafort.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So criminal charges against Paul Manafort have been coming and going for a while now, getting sentenced seems like multiple times. He had two different trials. And the as you were just saying, right, like the initial wave of charges against Manafort was like financial crimes that were at best loosely related to the investigation. But I think more stuff has come out that brings Manafort closer to collusion, right?
Yes, it's getting closer. And so what's happened lately is that Manafort struck a plea deal with Mueller in September to avert his second trial after being convicted at his first trial and committed to cooperate with the investigation, was questioned 12 times by prosecutors and twice went before the grand jury. And then Mueller's team said that they believed he had repeatedly lied to them on several topics and breached his cooperation agreement. They're not bringing new charges against him for this, but they're basically – because he's going to get such a huge sentence already, and they're kind of using this in the sentencing process to argue for – you know, to convince the judge not to go easy on him, essentially.
Right. Which is, for the record, it's all pretty standard. Like, this isn't a matter of, oh, they didn't really have the goods, because if they really had the goods on him, they'd be hitting him with new charges. The idea that someone has been cooperative or not or uncooperative as a factor in sentencing is right down the line standard operating procedure.
Right. So it was like he had a plea agreement, and what's come out now is not new charges exactly, but the complaint that his lack of cooperation means the sentence for the old charge should be very severe.
Yes. And so Manafort disputed that he had deliberately lied. And so over the past few months, we've seen some dueling filings and court hearing transcripts and an eventual ruling from Judge Amy Berman Jackson in D.C. Kind of assessing these claims. And they have been very fascinating. Very heavily redacted also, but there have also conveniently been some redaction errors. Manafort's team submitted one filing where they put black bars over text, but it turned out you could just copy and paste and see what was under the black bars. So we've learned a fair amount about what Mueller has been investigating from these filings, like why he clearly really wanted Manafort's cooperation and asked him about a lot of stuff. And these are a few of the topics that Mueller thinks he really had Manafort nailed on lying to him about. And I think for our purposes, the most important at making this kind of larger argument about collusion relates to Manafort's Russian associate Konstantin Kalimnik. So we learned that Mueller is accusing Manafort of sharing Trump campaign private polling data with Kalimnik in 2016 during the campaign. And also that Kalimnik, the FBI has assessed him as having ties to Russian intelligence in 2016. So this is yet another thing that, like, rightly should be treated as a major scandal, to have Donald Trump's campaign manager hand over private polling data during the campaign to a guy with ties to Russian intelligence. We don't know what purpose it was for, and so there are still arguments about whether this counts as collusion. Like, maybe this is one theory is that maybe this is Manafort just, like, trying to, like, keep oligarchs in Ukraine and Russia happy by giving them inside info and so on, that he wasn't asking for anything in return. But it's still, like, a big scandal, you know?
And this has always been, I would say, the strong circumstantial case for collusion has always been that once you accept that there is a Russian operation whose purpose is to help Trump win the election, then Trump's campaign manager just, like, had been hired previously by people with links to Russian intelligence for the purposes of tapping his political expertise. The universe in which the Russians kind of, like, have this guy who, for the question of, like, how to help win elections in Ukraine, they had asked what Paul Manafort's take was, but, like, now they're working on the United States and they would, like, forget to be in contact, right? Like, I mean, it wouldn't make sense to not collude. It's not, like, a legal argument. But that's why, to me, when you start to hear threads of this, right, that, like, Manafort, while working on the Trump campaign, was continuing to feed back stuff about the campaign through Kilimick, it's like, yeah, like, that's how you would, like, that's how you would do it, right? Like, there were people in the Russian government who were working with Kilimick and Manafort on political campaigns for many years. Like, that was his overt, non-secret, non-illegal job.
I think usually this is, his work is said to have gone through oligarchs rather than officials. So it's basically, like, oligarchs close to Putin or tied to the Russian government. And it's always been kind of difficult to connect Manafort directly to Russian government.
Right, but Kilimick was his partner, right? Like, his business partner on the ground in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And, I mean, again, who knows if this is true or not, but, like, U.S. intelligence sources,
yes,
I'm doing air quotes, like, say that he has, quote-unquote, ties to Russian intelligence.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know, you know, but I guess he probably does. It seems like he does.
This does kind of, as opposed to the Stone thing, where the question of, well, if you were soliciting information from WikiLeaks about when they were trying to drop, what their next Hillary-related intel was and when they were planning to drop it, like, whether or not you get that information, asking for it, you know, seems to be itself not in bounds. This, the Manafort stuff does, like, if somehow it could be decisively proved that he was passing this on to, you know, Kalimnik saying, just show this to the oligarchs, don't show it to anybody else. They want to feel included, let's you know, do them a solid. That would, in theory, be, as weird as it sounds, that would be exculpatory, I guess, insofar as it would demonstrate that there was some other purpose than conspiracy to interfere with the election, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, the it's not exculpatory because it's still scandalous, but,
right,
like, the exculpatory-ish theory about Manafort has always been he had his own thing going on. Like, he was out for himself. He was heavily in debt to a Russian oligarch. He was trying to line up future business for himself. And so he might have been doing stuff without Trump's knowledge or not even really aimed at helping Trump's campaign so much as aimed at helping himself secure future business and get paid.
So that's in the category of, like, scandalous but not illegal.
Yes. But then you have, like, you know, coming back to the question of giving this polling data,
mm-hmm,
and why would they give this polling data? And there have been a lot of interesting speculation and theories about this. We know that there are various social media propaganda efforts run by a Russian oligarch. Mueller has already filed charges in relation to that. The question of what this polling data shows exactly, like basically the incriminating theory, now that we've gone through the exculpatory-ish theory, is that Manafort is basically telling the Russians how they can best help the Trump campaign by informing them with this internal data so they can target their bots, their propaganda efforts and so on.
So like, you know, for example, one of the things that came up in the Internet Research Agency indictments was like the idea of these fake Black Lives Matter pages, right, that were designed to hit on the divisive race issues and therefore inspire a backlash among pro-Trump, you know, Republicans. Like, you're saying that in theory, one of the things that that polling data could be showing is, great, keep on with the race war stuff. This is awesome.
Yeah, they could have it could have focused on demographics and like strategies for depressing turnout among certain Democratic groups, or the ones most commonly pointed to are like efforts to hurt Hillary Clinton among Black voters, among Bernie Sanders supporters, and also among women, with like the kind of millennial women specifically, with the Bill Clinton, you know, drawing attention to Bill Clinton accusations.
All of which were tactics that the Trump campaign itself explicitly was engaging in.
Bannon was directly involved in all this. And then there's also the question of states, and like, that's also where it gets interesting. Like, if the internal polling data showed anything interesting about which states should be the focus of Russian help or so on.
Are you saying that Vladimir Putin took a campaign stop in Wisconsin?
I mean, that would certainly be interesting, but, you know, we're getting pretty far ahead of what's
Sorry. It was just too good to pass up.
I mean, an interesting question in this is, like, what is the significance for our understanding of what happened exactly? If it's, like, Trump's Russia-friendly campaign staff passed poll information showing that the Midwestern battlegrounds were the key, and for that reason, the Russians targeted their ads there, versus if the Russians just like read 538 and decided that the Midwestern, you know, because like, one reason it's so plausible that the Russians got that idea from Trump's internal polling is that like, it's true. So that's what the internal polling would have said. But one reason it's implausible is that like, it's also true. So like, that's what you would have done anyway.
And also, right? Hillary's campaign seemed to have been unaware of this.
Well, right. But it's like, what you would really want as a test, right, would have been something outlandish, right? Like, George W. Bush's campaign in 2000 appeared to have a private theory that California was in play and made a big last-minute push there. And that was like totally wrong. And the conventional wisdom was completely correct. So if some other actor had like also agreed with them there, you'd be like, oh, that's really fishy. Whereas like it both seems very fishy to have been like sharing polling information with this Ukrainian guy with ties to Russian intelligence, but also like the actual—
He's actually Russian.
Oh, Russian guy. Himself. There you go.
He lives in Russia now.
But like there's like such a confluence around this subject, right? Like Trump's private polling doesn't seem to have actually showed anything particularly distinctive.
Which, you know, not to pull us back far afield again, but it does go to the heart of the escalation from involvement to collusion to throwing the election, right? Like, it is pretty clear at this point that there were so many things that went into the election of Donald Trump that it's never going to be possible to definitively say if there had been no involvement between, you know, if Paul Manafort had never been hired and there had never been any sort of passing of polling data or whatever, the election would have gone to Hillary Clinton. Like, there are so many different factors here. The flip side of that is, in a close election, any one thing could have put anything over the top. But, you know, it's important to bear in mind when we're talking about this stuff that we are never going to get the answer to, if this hadn't happened, who would have won the 2016 election? And therefore, that shouldn't really be the standard.
Also, just to substantiate this kind of wild speculation a little more, back when Mueller wrote up his questions that he wanted to ask Donald Trump, a list of them leaked to the New York Times back in April. There were about 40 or so questions. And one of the questions really raised eyebrows. It was, what do you know about any efforts by Paul Manafort to get Russian help for the campaign? Right. And that was like the one, you know, a lot of the questions on the list were stuff we'd already heard about. And, you know, they didn't seem necessarily to betray any secret knowledge. But that's the one where people were like, wonder what that's about. And I think that maybe with this question of the sharing of polling data, which, to pinpoint the timeline a little bit, this allegedly happened on August 2nd, 2016. So Manafort had been chairing the Trump campaign for a couple months. It was after the convention. He had been exchanging some emails about with Kilimnik for some time. Kilimnik had written back to him about talking about caviar in code, which is really good code, apparently means money. And then they met in New York, and it's supposedly, according to Rick Gates, has told Mueller that that Manafort apparently handed over this polling data and walked Kilimnik through what the data meant and how to interpret it at this meeting. And Manafort basically disputed this. He said that, first of all, he said that he was just sort of forgetful about it when he didn't really mention it to Mueller. And then he said that, oh, it was mainly all public stuff anyway. It wasn't valuable data. And the judge did not buy this at all. She was extremely harsh on Manafort, saying it seemed very clear to her that he deliberately lied about this, and also that it would make no sense to secretly hand over this guy data that was already public. So this is just another example. So you have, at the very least, there's an allegation that Donald Trump's campaign chair handed over the campaign's polling data to a guy with ties to Russian intelligence. And, you know, combine that with, you know, Roger Stone was trying to get in touch with WikiLeaks about the hacked emails, and they have succeeded to some extent. And then you have the Michael Cohen aspect about the Trump Tower Moscow deal. So I think that's kind of the third prong of the collusion adjacent stuff, which we don't have to go in too much detail. But basically, it's been made clear in Mueller's court filings that Cohen was engaged in these talks to build a Trump Tower in Moscow during the presidential campaign, late into the presidential campaign, at least until June, and that he regularly briefed Trump and Trump family members about this, and then lied about it to Congress. And also, Mueller has alleged that this is a project that could have made the Trump organization hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. So this is like the new thing that makes us look back at what happened in the 2016 campaign and should rightly be considered like hugely scandalous. Like, the Republican presidential nominee or nominee in waiting was engaged in secret talks in a business project in Russia that could have made him and his family a ton of money at the same time as he was like being super nice to Putin and saying nice things about him.
I mean, that's like, in particular, actually, if you think back even further, right? If you think back to the Republican primary, right? And like, Trump is saying this like weird, like pro-Russian stuff back then. And other Republicans were still, you know, they were like thinking they were going to beat Trump. And that pointing out that lots of things Trump was saying was not in line with normal Republican policy were like going to devastate him. It turned out that like, rank and file Republican Party voters are like not that invested in foreign policy in Eastern and Central Europe topics, right? And like nobody really cared about these like, hey, you seem to love Vladimir Putin too much type takes. If it had been known at the time, right, that like Trump was like literally trying to close a deal in which he would personally gain tens of millions of dollars, that would have been a much more concrete sort of political controversy to go over, right? I mean, I think a lot of the Republican senators who are like now going to be defending Trump and saying this is no big deal would have thought it was a very big deal had they known it at the time that they were still trying to fight Trump, right? This sort of put like meat on the bones of a sort of esoteric foreign policy concern and turn it into like a full bore, like legitimate scandal, right? That like Trump was not answering questions about honestly, right? And like it would have been, it's weird. Not to say it wasn't a big story when it came out, but like it came out in the context of Trump already being president, everything being super partisan, like this Steele memo having set the bar for like a really broke type of conspiracy. Whereas like just like the fact that like, yep,
He's in here. Everyone's wondering, it's like, why is he even running? And it's like, yeah, he's trying to do a huge multi-million dollar real estate deal.
And it would have been the tallest building in Europe. So this is like obviously something Donald Trump would have cared about a lot.
Right. Like, I mean, even if we're not talking about a particular opponent who would have been able to use it in the active phase of the primary, like, we know that a lot of the Republican Party was not sold on Trump even going into the 2016 Republican National Convention. And simultaneously, during the deliberations over the platform, the Trump administration, or sorry, the Trump campaign actively made sure that harsh language about Russia's incursion into Ukraine was stripped from the platform. And we knew about that at the time. If you're thinking about a world where it's already known or it becomes known as part of that news story that Donald Trump is seeking to build Trump Tower Moscow, like Ted Cruz gave his speech at the convention, you know, as basically a middle finger to Trump, you know, all but refused to endorse, yada, yada. If you think about the world where we know what we know now as part of that, it's not that you could say he wouldn't get the nomination, but wow, does that cast his candidacy in a different light going into the general election? It's really difficult to overstate how much that would tie a bunch of things together that at the time, anybody who was drawing connections looked like they were wildly speculating at best and conspiracizing at worst.
Yeah, and of course, when we think back to the 2016 campaign and the coverage of Trump-Russia links and so on, I think there was a lot of skepticism that there was anything there. It seemed silly to people. And you know, if any one of these three things, there was at least some discussion about Roger Stone and what he might have known about WikiLeaks because of his tweet. But even I remember thinking back then that, I don't know, like I'm familiar with Roger Stone and his long history of kind of being a bullshitter in Republican politics. And there's a whole documentary about him that a lot of people make the argument that Roger Stone constantly tries to exaggerate his own importance and influence. So like, I didn't really, I don't know, the tweet didn't seem completely clear to me. So at the time, I was like, I don't know. And then, of course, you had the New York Times saying FBI sees no Trump links to Russia and so on. And so if any of these things had been known in more detail, like if there was like evidence that Stone was trying to get in touch with WikiLeaks that came out back then, that Manafort was handing over the polling data, that Trump was and Cohen were engaged in these Trump Tower Moscow talks, like it would have been a huge issue. And it probably would have. I mean, who knows? Like maybe it would have just gotten no coverage compared to Hillary's emails. But it at least had the potential of changing the outcome of the campaign if those things were known.
All right, let's take a second break, and then I'm going to ask, like, so what?
Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core, to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
What's up, guys? I'm Evan Turner, co-host of the Point Forward podcast, alongside Andre Iguodala. We got a special series out now, all about our favorite NBA cities, the greatest places to travel, the evolving cultures and cuisines, and some of our most memorable experiences while we were on the road during our many years in the NBA. We talk about Miami, Chicago, New York, and many more. Tune in to Courts and Culture, the Point Forward travel guide, sponsored by Hennessy. You can find it on Point Forward Feed on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.
OK, Okay, so I guess one question that I've had about this whole thing for a long time is like, so what? Right? Like, you could imagine a different world in which it turns out that Donald Trump has actually been the beneficiary of a sophisticated computer hacking effort by the government of Nigeria, right? And that the government of Nigeria has also maybe had some secret business deals with Donald Trump and various other things. And if this all came out, one thing it would raise in my head is like, oh my God, does Donald Trump have some secret, nefarious, pro-Nigerian agenda that like we don't know about before, right? That would transform our understanding of what's going on. Whereas the Russia collusion has been very like shrouded in secrecy and investigation. But like Trump's affection for Vladimir Putin is not exactly a secret, right? Like you can sort of take or leave that, it seems to me, like as a big deal. Or are we learning through these investigative nuts and bolts something that should really like what is the difference between guilt or innocence here?
You know, first off, when it comes to the consequences of the Mueller investigation's findings and whether Trump will, I don't know, face impeachment or something like that, I think for there, the bar has been set by Republicans mainly as like there has to be actual, you know, really smoking gun proof of, you know, something so horrible that and maybe not even then. Maybe there would be a way to excuse that too. So as far as why this matters, yes,
right?
Yes, Trump personally doing something. It's funny because when I try to think of what it would be, like it's so close to what we already know. I mean. You can find an argument to excuse anything. Like the Trump Tower Moscow talks seem super corrupt, but the argument to excuse it is, well, the deal didn't close, so it didn't end up happening. The WikiLeaks stuff too, it seems shady, but then the argument is, well, you don't have the proof that there was actually some sort of conspiracy. And it's true. We don't right now. I think as far as just our understanding of Donald Trump and what he does, I do think that like, something like the Trump Tower Moscow talks should cause us to look back on what he said during the campaign and question perhaps his motivations. But since he's taken office, there's obviously been this complex dynamic where he often says or does certain things and then the rest of his government, you know, there's clearly Russia has not gotten exactly what they wanted as far as the total lifting of sanctions, a perhaps acquiescence to a kind of Russia favoring peace deal in Ukraine or something like that, that would have been the Russian government's dream of like install what they would get from installing an ally.
But I think this is the thing. Here's like this would be the quo, right? It seems to me, if you had evidence of Jared Kushner or somebody else, right, like somebody in the narrowly Donald Trump orbit, saying or documenting in the context of an intra-administration dispute, right, that like the president needs to push back against some more establishment-y anti-Russian stuff because either they owe the Russians or the Russians have dirt on them, right? Like if you had a message, right, from somebody in Trump's inner circle back to Moscow saying, I know you're mad about this thing that just happened, but you need to understand, like, we can only go, right? Because that would be the dynamic, right? If Donald
that reminds me of Michael Flynn and what he talked
right.
to.
Right. Like, if Donald Trump is being blackmailed by the Russians, right, he would be in a complicated situation of trying to explain back to his runners in Moscow that he can't do everything that they would like him to do because that would blow up the whole thing. But they need to exercise forbearance and see these little tokens that he's giving them, like the Helsinki press conference and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
Like that would be the thing that would destroy Donald Trump. But it just seems so unfathomable, even if that's true, like that you would ever document.
You would never get Donald Trump on a hot mic telling Vladimir Putin that he would have more flexibility after the election.
But just because you've already seen the outputs, right?
Right.
And it's like, But I just don't, like, even as somebody who I personally am, like, I think speak for the American people and being not that invested in the intra foreign policy community dispute over the provision of lethal force to the Ukrainian government over the Donetsk region, blah, 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 blah. Right, right. Like, I don't know, man. This is why I always feel like there's like two brands of like Trump-Russia skeptics. There's like the people who think Trump is innocent, which seems ridiculous to me. But then there's the, like, I don't know, like, do we really care about this so much?
So I feel like the desire to make all of this a referendum on the character of Donald Trump is itself a function of Donald Trump's amazing ability to make everything about him. Like, I think it's also that there's now been so much attention devoted to this that there's a certain desire for a big climactic payoff. I mean, look, a lot of the hashtag resistance genuinely does believe that because what we know so far indicates a certain amount of illegitimacy in how Donald Trump went about seeking the presidency, that he is an illegitimate president and that therefore he should be hauled out in cuffs by the U.S. Marshals Service. Like, that is a belief that exists out there. Uh-huh. And I think a lot of people do genuinely want to see that and believe that that information sufficient to, you know, prove criminal charges either is already out there or might still be determined. But I think there are a lot of other people who haven't necessarily put that amount of thought into it, but who assume that if this is a big deal, it must reflect on the president ultimately, because that's what it means to have something be a big deal. It's not, you know, I think that there's a certain cognitive dissonance between the fact that the president's campaign manager has, like, been, you know, has been discovered to be passing along secret polling, and the idea that in order for this to be very serious for democracy, it must ultimately result in the impeachment of Donald Trump. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way, right? Like, we can talk about what happened in 2016 as having been aberrational and, you know, in some respects criminal, and quite possibly, you know, there could still in theory be charges of a conspiracy to, you know, interfere in the results of the election. That does not necessarily mean that Donald Trump is going to get thrown out of office over it. It may or may not mean that the election of 2016 was illegitimate. The legitimacy of elections is a subject for the political scientists anyway.
Well, and also I think that, like, the national security folks would probably say, having the president of the United States in debt to Russia in some way is bad, even if we know that Donald Trump tends not to pay his debts, even if we know that he seems to be being checked to some extent, at least, by the rest of his administration, that, like, this is still a bad thing that could have harmful dynamics. Then there's the question of corruption and cheating more generally.
Right.
Like, there's he cheated to win the election argument, and that's bad. And, you know, maybe it'll happen again if he gets away with it. Then there's just the argument towards, you know, corruption. And there are always arguments that, like, some people get more offended by corruption than others. And other people say, like, well, how much does this actually matter compared to all the other important issues that, you know, all the other policy issues that are going on? Like,
on the flip side, isn't everybody always corrupt anyway?
Yeah, although here's I think, a thing that's important, right? A turn that the Trump-Russia discourse has not quite taken, right? Which is that with the United States as the world's sole superpower, a key foreign policy strategy for many countries around the world is not to engage with the United States on the level of international relations, but to engage with the United States on the level of domestic policy, right? Because it is cheaper to buy influence in Washington, D.C. than to build up a military that is capable of exerting influence region-wide, right? And that's a thing that has been going on for 25 years, if not more. Donald Trump is more personally corrupt than any president I can think of, right? That he has so many mechanisms through which anybody can, like, put money into his pockets, including foreign actors. And we've seen numerous instances of this, right? Like, not just Trump Tower Moscow, but, like, this, like, weird Saudi party that, like, showed up at the Trump Tower New York. Many, many aspects of this, right, that relate to Russia because Russia is an important country, but are hardly exclusive to Russia. And I find, I mean, sometimes we have to get the worldly cast in here and sweat them. But it's like, because U.S. foreign policy consensus, like, has certain views, right, that, like, Vladimir Putin is a brutal dictator, like, in a bad way, whereas the brutal dictator of Bahrain is a brutal dictator in a good way. It's, like, really bad to be on the take from Putin, but really good to be on the take from the UAE. And, like, now maybe recently, because the Saudis killed a guy in a particularly grotesque way, it's, like, maybe going to be bad to be on the take from the Saudis. But if you were to suggest that anybody is on the take from Israel, like, that's anti-Semitic. And, like, it's a very confusing landscape out there, which, like, I think the door is open to, like, a bigger argument about corruption in American foreign policy, but that, like, that's not quite where the Russia discourse from, like, the ex-FBI counterintelligence officers on MSNBC is going.
So I guess, you know, what can we expect next? What, like, what should we be looking for in the future? Is there going to be a big climactic Mueller report? What's up?
Okay, so the short answer is that it's a bit of a mystery. The chatter from mainstream media reporters who have sources in the Justice Department is that Mueller's almost done and that there's going to be a report of some kind completed. And whether that is true, I guess we will see. It may be true. I think that the discussion about a Mueller report is extremely confusing, and there's a lot of misconceptions there. So here's the actual regulation about what it says about a special counsel report. At the conclusion of the special counsel's work, he or she shall provide the attorney general with a confidential report explaining the prosecution or declination decisions reached by the special counsel. So there are a couple of important things in there. One is the word confidential. Like, people talk like they expect this to be the 9/11 Commission report or something like that, or the Starr report. And this specifically says it should be confidential. Second is that it's supposed to explain prosecution or declination decisions. So it seems to be about, like, you know, why did you charge certain people and not other people? And that raises another important question about whether it will be made public or not, because Justice Department policy is to not talk about people who you did not end up charging with crimes.
Right, you wouldn't just, like, give a press conference, talk about how irresponsible they were, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Extremely careless.
That kind of
careless.
Thing,
careless.
That kind of thing gets you fired.
Yeah, it's not good.
That's
you don't
true.
Do that.
And then there's also, there are other questions like classified information, and it's basically very unclear what's going on here. There seems to be this expectation that Mueller is doing something like the Starr report that will be made public, but maybe he's not. And there is the alternative theory that Marcy Wheeler and others have put forward that he is basically speaking through his indictments, and that, like, whatever final word that Mueller has to say will be issued in an indictment, and that this report is a bit of a red herring. But then we should mention one other aspect to this, which is that was what the regulation says about the special counsel's report. But then it also says something about the attorney general and his reporting requirements. So it says, upon conclusion of the special counsel's investigation, to the extent consistent with applicable law, a description and explanation of instances, if any, in which the attorney general concluded that a proposed action by a special counsel was so inappropriate or unwarranted under established departmental practices that it should not be pursued. So basically, if Mueller recommends something and Bill Barr, who's now the attorney general, decides that it should not be done.
It's a witch hunt, fake news, based on a discredited dossier.
Bill Barr would be required to make some kind of report to Congress. And then also, there's another part of this that says that the attorney general may determine that public release of these reports would be in the public interest to the extent that release would comply with legal restrictions. So back when Bill Barr was getting confirmed, there's all these exchanges between him and Senate Democrats, where Senate Democrats were like, we want you to promise to make Mueller's report public. And he was like, I don't know if I can do that. And Democrats said, he's dodging. And I have a bit more of a sympathetic view toward Barr there, because I think that Barr, if his testimony is accurate, legitimately has no idea what Mueller is writing or what form it would be. If it is something that's highly classified, if it's something that is all about, like, why certain people were not charged because, you know, they shouldn't be charged, or other reasons involving grand jury secrecy, there are good reasons that, like, Bill Barr would have to, like, not make that report public.
Right, because, like, it's not like, as opposed to Matt Whitaker, who was in the Justice Department before being acting attorney general, like, Bill Barr would have no particular way of knowing these things.
Yes. I think it's clear that there is a plan that Mueller and Rosenstein, and it has been Whitaker lately, but Mueller and, like, the top DOJ people he's been working with, they have clearly been working towards some end goal. And maybe that end goal is to write a report that he does intend will be made public. But maybe it's not, and there's a different end goal of how he's handling it. And we just don't know what the plan is. And when Barr testified, he didn't know what the plan was either. So it was hard for him to make, like, a concrete commitment on what to make public or not to make public.
And then the other thing, right, is that it seems to me it makes such a big difference whether whatever it is that ultimately is alleged touches Trump personally or not, right? Like, it's such a bigger deal than the exact format in which these things are released. And that, like, an interesting thing about that Southern District of New York filing against Michael Cohen is that it appeared to be accusing Donald Trump of committing a crime without accusing him of committing a crime in any kind of formal forum.
Yes, and related, like, to the Stormy Daniels.
Right. But that, it feels to me, is, like, the real meat of this. Not, like, will some summary statement be released or not, but, like, if your conclusion is individual one committed the following crime, but we are not indicting him because he's the president of the United States, so I give this to you, Mr. Congress. Right? Like, that is information that—
Madam Congress.
Madam Congress. that is information that, it seems to me, like, the public clearly deserves to know, right? Like, if a reason for the decision to not prosecute,
yes,
is that the guilty party is the president of the United States.
So,
rather than the reason to decide not to prosecute is that he's innocent, right? Like, that's a big difference.
Yes.
And the public really needs to know which of them it is. And the way, one of the weird things about the Southern District investigation is that because they don't have any special counsel regulations or anything, they just kind of left this hanging out there. So we're all looking at it and we're like, huh, that's weird. And like, I would hope that Bill Barr or Robert Mueller or whomever will seek to provide clarity on this one particular critical question more than anything else. It's like, what are they saying about Donald Trump?
Yes, yeah, because that's what the report is framed in terms of Mueller's report in the regulation. It's about explaining prosecution and declination decisions, whether you bring charges against someone or whether you decided not to. And it is entirely possible that the report is like, Donald Trump committed all of these crimes and we have all of these details and evidence to prove it. And we're not going to charge him because he's the president and DOJ guidance says we should not indict a sitting president. And, like, maybe that's the report.
And it would be really bad. Like, if that's the report, you can't just leave that in a Justice, yes, Department filing cabinet, it seems to me. Whereas if the report is, like, a bunch of stuff about, like, this went on in the grand jury, and, like, that's why we didn't prosecute, like, Rick Gates's brother, then, you know, I mean, like, there's a reason this stuff is normally kept private, right? Like, and, like, what Comey did with Hillary, right? Like, you really aren't supposed to just, like, go blabbing about, like, stuff that came up in an investigation that's not chargeable. But I feel like I felt like the congressional testimony was sort of, like, beating around the bush here and, like, not answering the real question. I also have to think, right, like, whatever is done with the formal report, right, like, Mueller will continue to exist as a human being. He's been very Sphinx-like throughout most of this process. But there was that one moment with the BuzzFeed story where he was like, no, I have to
say something about this. It's hard for me to imagine a universe in which Mueller reaches the conclusion that Donald Trump has committed multiple serious crimes, but a little like bureaucratic gotcha prevents him from delivering that information to the public. I mean, who knows, yes. Right? Maybe he's such a straight shooter that he wouldn't leak that memo, but I mean, I don't know, man.
What I'm concerned about is I think that it's much more likely that the Mueller investigation does not come to a conclusion about the personal culpability of Donald Trump for any of a multitude of other reasons, right? Like, they don't feel they have enough information and they're not going to continue the investigation solely into the person of the president himself because they already know the DOJ guidance, et cetera. Or, like, they genuinely do believe that he is innocent and aren't going to, you know, they're not going to try to counteract that presumption because all of the evidence they have now suggests, or most of the evidence or whatever, suggests that Donald Trump was personally not legally culpable, whatever else you might say about his responsibility. I feel like anything short of a memo that literally says we would have indicted President Donald Trump for XYZ, but we can't because he's the president, is not going to be, like, frankly, I think that the trust in Mueller invested by people who are critical of Trump is not unconditional. And I would be very surprised if any kind of conclusion of the Mueller investigation that doesn't include a Donald Trump is guilty as sin smoking gun may I think that that's probably going to result in a lot of the hashtag resistance seeing the Mueller investigation as less legitimate or saying that like Bill Barr stepped on it or that it's been corrupted in some way or that Robert Mueller wasn't in fact the hero of democracy we thought he was. Like, I think that at this point, the expectations have been set so high that the likelihood that whatever comes out of this is actually seen as clarifying in terms of building a political consensus as to what happened and what role the president has in it is unlikely. And I think we should maybe start preparing ourselves for that possibility now.
You mean we're not going to reach political consensus?
Yes. Sadly, we're not going to reach political consensus.
Well, I do think that you know, I just talked about the possibility of a report of damning evidence against Trump and we're not going to charge him because he's the president. And as you say, there's also the possibility of the evidence wasn't there or the evidence was mixed. And that's why I think it's important that the report is about explaining the prosecution or declination decisions. Because, you know, if they decide not to prosecute Don Jr. or Trump or whoever, despite like maybe considering it seriously, they have to explain why. And so theoretically, the report would say, like, we found this evidence, but, you know, we didn't think the evidence was strong enough.
Yeah, and I just don't know that, like, there's very little incentive for Democrats to leak that, and there's very little incentive for Democrats in the field to believe it.
The other thing I would say, though, about this is that one reason I expect this to not make a huge political difference going forward, unless there's some big new things, is that it feels to me like it is already made a substantial difference, right? Like, if Trump was riding high in the polls, right, with like a 65% approval rating based on the historically low African-American unemployment and stuff like that, then like information that came out about his shady dealings with Russia, you could easily see like normally Democratic-leaning voters who'd been impressed by Trump's strong performance in the job turning against him, even some wavering moderates being like, oh, I don't know about that guy. But like his numbers In the low 40s, you're talking about a group of Trump approvers who are like already fairly hardcore. The lower you get as a president, like the harder it is to like persuade marginal people to turn against you. And I do think that's like another important piece of context for this, right? Like the interesting thing about Monica Lewinsky is that that didn't knock Bill Clinton down from a high point. You know, whereas like Trump is starting at a not like a terribly low point, but a pretty low point where like Trump approvers, I think, like really agree with him about consequential matters of national policy. And so it's hard to, you know, disabuse them of that.
I do also think that we haven't really talked about the obstruction of justice part of this, but we know that there is a very, very extensive investigation into whether Trump tried to obstruct the investigation. And like we've known about that for a long time. It relates to stuff like the Comey firing and attacking Sessions and all other kind of efforts to interfere with the FBI. But we've never really seen, sometimes there is a power in like the news cycle of having this all put together in one place, maybe with some new stuff and with like some big takeaway like findings there.
Yeah.
So like if the Mueller, like let's say there's nothing, there's no smoking gun on collusion and like literally what we've talked about today is the extent of the collusion story. And but also what we already know about is the extent of the obstruction story. And that looks really bad. Like it is possible that the Mueller report, well, let's say a Mueller report comes out, it's damning on obstruction. Perhaps it says we're not charging him because he's president or something like that. And then I think you get to the question of House Democrats and, you know, how do they not move to impeach based on this? I guess it's possible that they won't. But like I tend to suspect that if Mueller's findings, however they are released or not released, are anything more damning than no collusion witch hunt, like there's going to be a lot of pressure on House Democrats to do something about it. Like, what are they going to do if Mueller's like, all right, there was no collusion, but the president seriously obstructed justice and like and made all of these completely outrageous efforts to interfere with the Justice Department? Are Democrats just going to say, oh, well, I guess we'll just have to beat him in the next election. We're not going to, like, do anything about this right
now. I think
now.
They will.
I'm now really hoping for a Mueller report that is one page, no collusion, witch hunt, XOXO Robert Mueller.
Yeah, well, we will have to have you back on to discuss it at that point. I'm not sure that the House Democrats' enthusiasm for Mike Pence administration is actually all that high. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens. So thanks, Andrew, for coming on, explaining this to us. We like to get back into Russiagate every few months. It's always a pleasure. Thanks, of course, to our sponsors and to our producer, Jeffrey Gelb. And The Weeds will be back on Friday.